So, quantum hello to you.
That's not the proper use of that word.
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant S hello to you.
S hello to you too.
Mm-hmm. I mean ultra hello to you. I mean marketing gobbledygook to you. How's your CES?
I watched a 5-minute cut down of a keynote video, and it made me sad and gave me a headache.
Mm. Did it cut you down?
Yes, it cut me down.
Mm-hmm. The cut down cut you down?
What are these companies doing? Like, is CES always like this? And I don't follow the coverage like ever. But I tried to watch a video about Samsung's new TV, and apparently it has better contrast. And then they have some new vacuum cleaners that are going to revolutionize the home.
Mm-hmm.
That's about all I got out of the video.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it strange?
It's very strange. Mm-hmm. Especially this. I want to slap whoever coined this term, quantum dot TVs.
I don't know. It's all nanocrystals, man.
Nanocrystals. Are these the kind that if you keep on your bedside table, it'll bring you good chi or something while you're sleeping?
I don't think it's that kind of a thing, although...
Crystals are very healing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or so I've been told.
It helps center you.
Which is important if you have a curved TV.
Yeah, you want to
center... You should always sit centered.
You want to center it. There'll be a little bit of overscan, so you're going to lose some picture on either side, like usual, of course.
Now, do I have to adjust out the keystoning in my eyeballs, or does that happen automatically?
I don't know. I'm not really an expert on the curved, crazy bananas technology and the things.
Do you think the TVs were based on somebody eating a banana and then realized that the curve would be a useful detail to add to the television?
It seems like they did that for the all those curved phones they designed. I don't get the...
Yeah, those sold really well, didn't they?
Well, yeah, but then they came out with another one. LG's like, oh, man... This was such a bad idea, we'll do it again. And they have the LG G Flex 2 or whatever that they came out with at CES. It's just like, oh, God, people, have some self-respect. Like, just be willing to admit that you have no ideas and that your only ideas are bad ideas. And that sometimes it's best just to make a good TV or just make a good phone. And that the marketing gobbledygook only justifies middle managers and, like, C-level executives. And it does nothing... Does nothing really for a lot of other people. Like, most of the people who are going to buy these TVs, these fancy TVs, are not reading any of this. They're just going to go into a Best Buy. They're going to stare at whichever one is set up the worst. And then some guy will be like, oh, let me sell you this one because I have a commission. And then I'll convince you to buy that one based on these numbers that are on this thing that sound impressive. And so then that's it at the end of the day. So then what's the point of CES? What's the point of all this marketing technobabble?
Well, these first few TVs that come out are going to be ridiculously expensive and very dumb. So those are going to be for the early adopters who actually care about the numbers. But I think the worst part is this, like, marketing gobbledygook of shud or whatever we're going to call these things. Most of this stuff is probably outsourced.
That the SUHD.
Yeah, I'm calling it shud.
Yeah, yeah. As well, you should. But that is. Just Samsung. That's just their marketing spin on their flavor of UHD. Because like all good standards, you should have flavors for it.
Still Wait, has UHD been actually released as a standard yet?
Oh, it has. And then it's done so well as a standard that they've gone through and made a new standards body alliance. Did you see that?
No, I didn't see that.
they got a bunch of the TV manufacturers together, and they're like, hey guys, should have an alliance of all of us agreeing on stuff. And that's not really working super well so far, because it seems like already right out of the gate we have Samsung with their SUHD. It is unclear whether or not the color gamut ranges that the different manufacturers are using will be standardized, or if that's just going to be...
Well, it's not really possible now, is it?
Well, it's possible to, like, at least say, like, within this range, your stuff is going to work. Like, you can market it and label it as something with this name. If you can display this color range, if these colors will map and display correctly. I don't know if they ever plan on doing that, but that's kind of the promise of what Dolby's HDR thing was supposed to be last year, was that it wasn't a bigger resolution. It was just more color, better contrast, higher detail, that kind of thing. And so in the Variety article that I read, which is not a good source for technology, that they were like, well, maybe they'll have some of the manufacturers have hinted at having UHD HDR TVs. So that's good. Then you've got two things that you can say you have on your TV.
This thing you sent me on CNET says the Samsung TV is not quite 100% coverage of DCI color space, which I guess if you're going to aim for another color space, that's fine. I mean, there's not really a point in labeling it with your own silly branding name because you're already aiming for a predefined color gamut. And, you know, as color gamuts go, DCI is a good step up from Rec. 709, I guess. But,
well, yeah. I mean,
rather than saying like we're almost at 100 DCI, why don't you just say yes, we can reliably get sRGB, and that's a thing people understand, and that's probably all anyone would really need or care about, unless until you get into the HDR stuff.
Oh, I don't think anybody even understands what sRGB is.
Well, you can just say it's got as many colors as your computer monitor, and that's something people would understand.
Okay, but still with DCI, like they can't say they have DCI because they don't, and they don't want to say that they have Rec. 709 because they don't, so that's why they have the thing that they called it. But I don't know why they aren't targeting Rec. 709. I'm sorry, why they aren't targeting DCI more closely. And for listeners at home that might not know what that is, that was another standard that was created so that all the film DI processing stuff could be standardized. At least that's my recollection of it. So DCI is good, and it came after Rec. 709, and it came after, well after sRGB, which was, I think was like mid early 90s.
I thought sRGB was older than that, and then Adobe RGB and all that other stuff came out afterwards.
Yeah, okay, so Adobe RGB might be the one I'm thinking of, and then the mid 90s. Anyway, color spaces.
We're talking about color gamut here. It's just how many colors out of the theoretical infinite amount of colors, well, not infinite, your image can represent it. It's that goofy sort of parabolic and flat on one side color image that most of you have seen. Rec. 709 has a smaller triangle within that. sRGB has more colors, and DCI has more colors. But, I mean, is there even worth talking about the futility of trying to support DCI color gamut on something that is not a digital cinema player? Like, this conversation is on the verge of going down a gigantic rat hole of the fact that, again, let's step back and what are we feeding into these TVs? It's certainly not
That was going to be the next thing I was going to talk to you about, is that part of this alliance thing is also about getting people to agree to broadcast and make available UHD content. Part of that has to do with Panasonic is going to have a 4K Blu-ray player. And I've only seen the announcement from Panasonic, and I did not see a follow-up from them yet on who else may be making that, and if it is something else other people will make, or if it's going to be like a rehash of DVD plus R and DVD minus R, or if it's going to be like Blu-ray and HD DVD, and everybody's going to come out with their own, which would be unfortunate because, God, don't do that. It didn't work out well. if there is uncertainty about buying into something, people won't buy it, and they'll just continue down their path of streaming and otherwise obtained digital media. I don't understand. I don't see enough of this content being standardized and released as fast as it should be by this point. If UHD has been around for basically what, like 2 years, basically? Because it was pre-CES last year. And
you're talking about the standard or the actual format? Because the format's older, but it hasn't really existed in the public mind.
I meant the broadcast standard. Because there's also the specifications of like how many frames, the encoding, all that stuff. If you go to the Wikipedia page, it's very boring.
I don't want to do that. I'm looking at the DCI Wikipedia page, and it's making me
that
tired.
One's also very boring. So anything with just like a couple letters, pretty boring. And so it's just one of those things where it's just like there's even though Netflix is saying they're going to have UHD stuff, that's at Netflix streaming quality, so it's still compressed a lot. So it's not like it's, you know, going to be as good as what the 4K Blu-rays will be. And even that, there's still another step removed from Sony for a while has had these little media boxes that you could buy for your mansion, where they
like the giant hockey puck looking things.
Yeah, and they would stream 4K content from Sony, and those have been available for a while, but you need like the special projector setup and all that bananas crazy stuff.
And you can't put content on them yourself.
Right. Yeah, because it's basically letting you stream sort of I think either exactly the same quality as what they send out to theaters or nearly that. I don't remember what the rule for that is.
Yeah, I don't remember either. It's close, though. I was at CineGear 2 years ago. I got the demo on it from a Sony fellow. They were showing After Earth in 4K.
Oh, good one.
it looked really bad, and I hope it was the camera they were using. Although that was the Sony F65, I believe they shot that one on, which is a very... for listeners at home, that's a camera that costs about as much as a house, and it was not so great. But I'm looking at the UHD here. I know we've talked about this before. It is a larger color space than Rec 709, but it doesn't seem to comply really in any way towards DCI. So again, we're kind of all over the place with what we're picking and choosing here. And for the streaming options, I imagine H.265 is still kind of half-baked, right? So we're probably going to end up with some H.264 4K compression or something?
I'm assuming, because the Blu-ray standard, as far as I know, is only H.264. So they're doing...
Blu-ray is still Rec 709, isn't it?
I think it is. But so basically, the 4K Blu-rays that are going to be available will be Rec 709, and they'll have H.264 encoding. So, I don't know how many discs.
Terrible.
This whole thing is just a complete cluster, basically, because there's so many little things on a spreadsheet now that you're going to have to check off in from the content being delivered to you to the thing that you're playing it on for your media storage to the thing that you're using for your actual display to see with your eyeballs. That it's just like a complete. Total mess. It's not like it used to be back in the day where everybody would either have a TV or you didn't have a TV, or you'd have a VCR player or you didn't have a VCR player. And then, you know, things have gotten subtly more complicated than that. Sure, there was HD with the division between, you know, 720p and 1080i and 1080p, and everybody's like, "Oh, 1080p is the best." And so that's good. There were only like a couple little options in there, and so now we've gotten to this point where we have like a gajillion different options that you have to like go through and check off and be like, well, is this disc that I'm going to buy, is that going to work on my TV that I will have, that I'm going to buy from Samsung or Sony or whoever is making it? Is this what is the point if you can't there's no certainty, and there's no, like, these standards are all like fly by night standards, so it's just like it's a mess. And I don't understand why anyone would announce this alliance if they haven't actually worked on anything to announce together yet, and they're just announcing all of their individual separate products.
Everyone is really just building things with as much technology as they can because they think that's what people want, but they're not like, nobody's aiming for a standard at this point. They're just saying like, how big a color gamut can we go? Well, we can almost go DCI. I was like, okay, do that. And how much resolution can we get with the technology we've got now? Well, about UHD. So do that and then ship them. And then we'll figure out later why it's the coolest. But I don't think anyone is really interested in the future of the ecosystem at this point, because I mean, if we're talking about these like walled gardens like iTunes, like if we're talking about a future where Samsung TVs are fed by Samsung boxes and Samsung formats, like they don't have to care about abiding by any particular standard. They'll just do what's best for them. But that's going to make a really uncomfortable world for the consumer, which we're already kind of in. So this is, I guess, as they say, it gets worse before it gets better. But I'm going to hold out for Super High Vision. When Super High Vision lands in the United States, that's going to be my jam.
I can't tell if you're joking or not.
Are you not familiar with Super High Vision?
No, I've never heard of that before in my life.
Super High Vision is NHK's 8K format.
Oh God!
It's been around for about 3 or 4 years in Japan. Every NAB, they always have like a demo in the back of one of the halls where they have this like they have a giant projector screen and you can watch 8K, and it's either 60 or 120 frames a second with a 22.2 surround sound system. Like that's they've had this same camera, which is actually in the UHD Wikipedia article. I don't know why the Super High Vision camera is in the side here, but it's a camera that's about, God, I don't even know. It's about the size of a Mac Pro if it were a square, like the old Mac Pro, and it's got like I think it's something like a 16 dual link SDI that comes out to this giant box on top of it that looks like a toaster oven. But yeah, it's 8K, and they've been doing that for a while. They've been broadcasting 8K for a while, like over the air, which is an insane proposition. But
it sounded like you said HK.
8K.
Yeah.
No. So Super High Vision is a thing, and NHK was around for the invention of the original HD standard, so they kind of know what they're doing.
Yeah. Well, my one thing I'd point out with that is, SuperVision is even more limiting in terms of content availability.
Oh, absolutely. There's like two of these cameras. Like, if you ever talk to the guys, which they really don't like to reveal a ton of stuff about this camera, like there's two cameras and there's two like completely bespoke custom-made lenses that fit on them. And you can't like move them or do anything. So like all of their footage is like waterfalls in Japan. It's really nice looking stuff. But yeah, there's not a lot of content for these things. I mean, the coolest proposition I ever heard for this like ultra HD stuff is where they basically, for sports, they find an angle where you can see the entire field, point the 8K camera at it, and then you can do like a center crop HD image out of it that follows the players around. And some people, they can give you like a little PlayStation controller and you can go watch whatever part of the field you want whenever you feel like it. Like you can run around and look at stuff, which is kind of an interesting way to interact with your TV. But
wouldn't the lens on that be really strange?
It's gigantic is what it is.
I mean, like if you were cropping in that much on an image that size, wouldn't like it just look weird because it's from because of the lens being used? You're zooming in so far on that to like if you were like going to like HD resolution out of an 8K image.
You can get a decent punch in from HD from 8K down to HD without having a whole lot of weird things happen.
Okay, so it wouldn't look like you were looking at some weird, you know, like wide angle lens kind of a distortion thing.
No, because the sensor size, if I recall, is large enough that the wide angle doesn't look super distorted.
Okay. Well, that is certainly something to look out for.
And if people listening to this are super duper confused right now, just imagine people with maybe slightly more knowledge about these things than us making decisions about how you're going to watch it. And that's pretty much the world we live in.
Mm-hmm. And how. So next year, year of the 8K desktop, or year of the Linux desktop. Or whatever.
Super High Vision is not going to come to the United States for a very long time, if it ever does. But it's always a cool demo to go see the NHK booth at NAB. I assume they have one at CES, too. But you wait in line for 10 minutes, and you go watch in their little portable movie theater, their gigantic 8K images, which looks real nice, but yeah.
Is it all projected?
Yeah. Well, it's digitally projected, but yeah.
Yeah. So they have an 8K projector?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Interesting.
This also says, in May of 2011, Sharp collaborated with NHK, demonstrated an 85-inch 8K 10-bit display for their super high vision stuff, which is apparently the only super high vision display.
Oh, well, it's they got half of one for every camera now.
Yeah, right. Although I should mention, I just looked at this Wikipedia page now, and I was reading the one earlier for our movie this evening, Snowpiercer. Mm. And did you know Wikipedia allows you to cite a tweet as a source?
Oh, why?
it said this, the Snowpiercer was shot on 35mm anamorphic as well as 1.85, and I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. And I clicked over to IMDb, and it's like, no, just 35 spherical. And I'm looking at the lenses, and it's like, okay, Ultra Primes and Angino Optimos. I'm like, those are not anamorphic lenses. And then I went back and I clicked the source, and it's a tweet.
Just from some rando?
It's a tweet from somebody who writes for like a film website or something, and it doesn't even mention anamorphic. It just mentions that the movie was shot on 35mm film. It's like, well, thanks, genius, but all right. I don't know where you guys are getting this anamorphic stuff, but I think you're wrong, Wikipedia.
So as we've established, formats, super easy to understand. No one ever gets them wrong. Dear. Oh, dear.
I'm going to start selling anamorphic UHD TVs, so it'll be AUHD.
I still like my marketing tagline that the SUHD will be...
It'll be an S hit.
Yes, yes.
Uh-huh. That was good.
I'm so clever with my potty mouth.
I mean, so... more pixels is good. Capabilities of higher frame rates are good. But for... And we get back to the same thing. There's no content available in these formats. We can up-res everything for a while and we'll be fine, but what are we up-resing to? Are we just going to up-res to every format that every hardware manufacturer has the whim to create? That's just ridiculous.
Yeah, well, also, just as I've repeatedly harped on, with these formats, when you're up-resing this stuff, even if they go back through and they like pull... the film again, and actually get like a much better resolution image out of the original film stock. Even if they go through all of that effort, they can't do that on the effects shots. Anything that has effects in it, they are not going to spend the budget to redo the effects. So all of the effects will be scaled up. And people don't understand how many shots in a movie these days have effects in them. It's usually in the neighborhood of somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000, potentially higher on many of these big budget action things. And it can be silly, dumb things in a shot. It can be like, oh, well, we want to remove a marker that we forgot to take out. And, oh, we want to get rid of the cab that's in the background. Like, things that people don't even see. And then suddenly that makes it an effects shot. And so suddenly that means that you'd have to go back in and redo all of that work at a much higher resolution. And nobody's going to have the budget to do that, so they're just going to blow up all of those shots. So it just makes me aggravated.
Well, yeah, not only would you have to go back in and redo the work at a higher resolution, should we bother discussing the color gamut of a VFX pipeline?
No.
Because it's not DCI.
It is in some places. Anyway.
Cineon, what is it? It's a 10-bit log. So that comes out to roughly 12-bit linear, right? That's not... well, I guess it depends on the file format you choose. If you go with EXR, you'd be all right.
There's a wide variety of things used on different projects. So we can't really speak for all of things, just like we can't speak for all of the content that would be available for these things.
Right, I was just going to say the average Cineon color gamut compared to DCI. I don't know that off the top of my head.
But who's been using Cineon? I mean, in the past...
DPX, same thing.
Yeah, okay. But still, like, whatever Log 10 thing you have, like, there's all those different flavors of Log 10 for slightly better things. You know, like Alexa has their own Log 10, and everybody's doing it. It's the thing. Just like all the standards, you should have your own. It varies what like kind of quality you get out of that, what level blacks clip at, what level whites clip at. And I am referring, of course, to the lowest values and the highest values in an image. So they're not even consistent between all of the different log 10 things out there. So
no, yeah. I can't even, what is it off the top? 65, like 985, something like that?
Don't show off, Dan.
We'll cut all this out. No, this is all I've ever been good at is memorizing standards.
memorizing numbers from standards.
No, because somebody would scream and yell from the other edit bay, like, why does my QuickTime look dark or something? It's like, well, in your conversion from this to ProRes, you forgot to do the YUV, blah, 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 and your gamma's screwed up. And then they would just stare at me blankly until I go fix it for them, which is just miserable.
You're like that Andy Samberg SNL IT guy.
You're not the first person to accuse me of something like that.
Oh, well, that should tell you something.
Yeah.
It should be a big red flag.
One of my beloved prizes from NAB many, many years ago was this thing Avid gave out. It was like this bound, it was like a book basically, but it was just like 60 pages of standards and terminology. And I would always refer to that because I thought it was super interesting, which should further explain everything you need to know about me.
Mm.
I still have it around here somewhere.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it explains all of the various ProRes formats. What does ProRes HQ mean versus ProRes Lite and all that garbage, mm-hmm. which nobody bothers to pay attention to?
ProRes 444.
4444.
Oh, yeah.
So you get an uncompressed alpha channel, too, because people are really passing around alpha channels in QuickTimes. What a terrible idea.
I don't know. So there's the things.
I think we've officially lost everyone after our after last week's episode, which was probably relatively entertaining for people. We've spoken for almost a half hour and neglected to speak about food at all.
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, this episode's poison, so let's just get that right out of the way.
food probably looks really good at 8K or 4K or whatever.
I can't imagine the level. You know, the people that have to gather around and like put all that garbage on top of the fast food and the photo shoots and stuff just so it looks like presentable, delicious stuff, even though it's completely inedible stuff that they're putting on it. Can you imagine like being the person doing that, and you have to do it for like an 8K quality image?
At this point, I would just give up on like pretending that the commercials are full of real food and just like making CG.
Mm-hmm.
Although a CG 8K image would probably be kind of a giveaway.
Yep, a little crisp.
Speaking of crisp.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the snowy bits in tonight's movie.
Oh, spoiler horn.
Bonk.
Yeah, no, you gotta do the thing. It's the fog horn from the garage bands.
Sure, I'll find that later.
Okay. to-do list. GTD. With the things with this movie and the crispy. I interrupted you. Go back.
Oh no! I was just gonna say some of the wintry snowy bits looked a little crisp.
Yes, yes. So spoiler: there's snow in this movie.
spoiler in the movie, Snowpiercer. Which before we get into it, did anyone at any point in this movie say the word Snowpiercer? I've come to learn through reading things that Snowpiercer is the name of the train. Were you aware of that?
Yeah. Well, I knew it before I watched it. I knew that, but I also thought I heard them say it a couple times in the film when they were talking about the train itself. But usually they
Is that through the bit where it actually pierced through the snow that was on the tracks?
let's not get ahead of ourselves.
I feel like we should spend a little bit of time talking about general feelings on the movie before we try and dive into any sort of specifics. Okay. Just so we don't sound like hate mongers.
Okay. Well, first of all, I hated it. So, mongering done. I shouldn't say I completely hate it. I thought there was a lot of there were interesting ideas in here, and there was I think some good cinematography in several parts. There was some bad cinematography in several parts, and that there were some good performances delivered by actors in here. Unfortunately, the story suffers a lot in many places, and notably the end, and the directing is seemingly all over the map in terms of tone and how I should feel about the things that are happening and the people here. I mean, they're not very good people, any of them. And so it's hard to feel great about stuff. But the main thing I object to is the gratuitous, I feel gratuitous, violence that is especially present right before they get to the water section of the train. I can't say enough bad things about that sequence. I don't think I think that that just goes on way too long. It doesn't really... I don't feel anything even about the semi-main character that dies, because I didn't like him at the beginning of the movie, and so when he died, I was just like, okay, whatever. And then at the end, we get the exposition about him, and I'm like, oh, so that's why we were supposed to care about him. And then it's like, yeah. Well, but why did you tell me that like 10 minutes before you end the film? Like I don't understand. Like
you're referring to the kid who was a jerk in Jumper and evidently a jerk here as well.
Yeah, Jamie Bell.
Yeah. You touched on something that was a big feeling for me, is that in terms of why I don't really care about these people is because there is like zero character development. And part of that, I guess, is the way they tell the story and what you just referred to, you know, the sort of, it's very odd that the exposition bomb that explains most of the things is at the end of the movie, which it seemed necessary to do at some point, and maybe there wasn't a natural place to tell it, or maybe they thought it would be sort of a suspenseful reveal. But most of the time I'm watching this, it's just like, why am I watching this and why do I care? Like, who are these people and what is their purpose here? Like, that kid who his second in command, I guess they were buddies because they were like talking and stuff. But in the opening scene, I couldn't tell if they were like friends or like adversaries, because he's telling them to, like, you know, crouch down as they tell you to crouch down, like, you know, don't start any trouble. It's like, oh, okay, later I guess we find out they're co-conspirators. But there's an awful lot of world building, to use a common term, in this movie, but not much character building. And then the large exposition at the end there, where Mr. Evans has his tearful breakdown, it didn't really do anything to me, as most large exposition bombs don't. So yeah, most of the time I was confused and just trying to take everything in and keep it in my memory so I could try and connect the dots later. But like I have, as usual, like 7 pages of notes and my little field notes here, and most of them end with question marks because they either did not get answered at the time, or I could not connect the dots. So there was a lot of stuff that it happened for a reason, and I don't know why.
Okay, I guess we can delve into those or not. I think that's my single biggest problem with this film, I have to say, is the ending. And I include everything from when they get to that final car with the bridge in it over the gears. Everything past that point is just nonsense. Like it is all out of left field.
Well, should we start with the conceit of the movie, which is that to combat global warming, we had a bunch of airplanes fire chemtrails out the back of them to cool the atmosphere down to an apparent acceptable temperature. But oops, we screwed up, and now the entire world is frozen.
Yeah. Well, no. See, I like that. That's fine. People make mistakes. It's nice and bleak.
Oh my God. Sure. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then the following premise is that a kid who was a big fan of trains decided one day he wanted to build an entirely self-sustainable train that he could live on for all eternity. And then there's some hand-waving about how he saw the writing on the wall, and he knew that the supercooling doodad wasn't going to work. So this was sort of like his end-of-the-world bunker. And then I missed the part where they selected the people to be on the train, but evidently people had tickets because there were more doomsday conspiracy folks who wanted to buy into his train thing. And then there were a bunch of people who stowed away before the world froze over and everyone died, and that's the people in the back of the train. Does that roughly cover it? What I got from it.
They didn't stow away. They were allowed to board, but then they were just shoved back there and not given anything. But the justification for any of these things occurring is not there. And that's my biggest problem with it. Now, it's based on a graphic novel where this takes place. And we should say also that this is really a metaphor. Like, this is not meant to be our literal future. Like,
it's not the subtlest of metaphors, with a very clearly defined caste system between the rich and poor, and everyone in their place, and everyone should remain in their place and not upset the order. And that's said over and over in a number of different ways and places.
Yeah, but see, the one thing that I have against this is apparently in the graphic novel it was more nuanced in terms of like a class structure. Here there's basically three options. You are either in the back of the train, you are in the front of the train, or you are in charge of the train. And that is it. Like there's no other structure. There's no like middle class on this train, nothing like that. Like it is a very extreme divide. And so for me personally, I find that metaphor to be a little too two-dimensional. And of course, like we said, this is based on a graphic novel, but it does seem like the novel might have been more nuanced on the subject than perhaps the film is.
Well, then we get this other metaphor of the sort of like the lord of the front of the train and the lord of the back of the train working in concert together to make sure that the order is not upset. So you have to have, is this a heaven and hell metaphor, the gone awry or something? But you've got the guy in the back of the train who understands why he needs to keep the people down in the back of the train, and the guy at the front of the train, and they collaborate together. There's, I don't know about you, but I felt in a number of places an odd reminiscence to The Matrix here and there. Did you feel that at all?
Ed Harris, the architect.
Apparently this is the version of The Matrix where Neo was not willing to, well, I guess in The Matrix, where he's not willing to accept his role and decides to bail on the whole proposition.
There, like I said, there are some things that I like in here, and I like production design stuff. I like the costume work. I like the acting performances put in by some of these people, many of these people. I cite probably Tilda Swinton's as my favorite because it is so outlandish. While these performances can be very broad, like Alison Pill as the teacher, they're all actually quite good for what they are in the film. Now, the one exception to that is Ed Harris at the end, who I think just, I don't know what he was trying to achieve with that. He was just sort of numb, like he'd been to a dentist's office. It didn't work out for me. And Chris Evans as Curtis, as our hero, he does a good job of being this hero who's got a chip on his shoulder, who's got to see things through most of it, right up until, like I said, the very end. And then I believe you had put this as a joke title suggestion in our Slack, but Babies Taste the Best, which we are not using as a title for this episode, but his whole breakdown and his confession about what a bad person he is, and he feels like he's a bad person because of Ed Harris, because of Wilford, that whole thing just seems so random because it wasn't woven through the rest of the film. And so you sort of have this little switch flip from him being this competent like hero for these people to all of a sudden being sort of aimless at the very end. That is very strange. And his companions all pretty much die, which is also sort of depressing. I was saddest when Tilda Swinton died, because that was I knew was not anywhere near the end of the film, so it was going to be a long slog to go through the rest of it without her. And the bad guys, the other bad guys, the henchmen bad guys, they did not do anything for me.
The guy with the hair who doesn't die, who we don't know anything about, yet we're supposed to be afraid of him or something, that guy drove me nuts. But getting back to what you were saying about Chris Evans' character, In the beginning there where he's doing the, you know, I could never be a leader, this and that stuff, it seemed sort of out of left field because he seemed to be doing the job of the leader. And I could see where perhaps a more subtle usage of this story in maybe the graphic novel could further illustrate his guilt over the monster he had become when they resorted to eating people and children. And the reason he decided to sort of lead this revolution is because he wants to finally give back, do right by his fellow man who suffered through all this, and at his own knife, evidently, because he was one of the biggest monsters who was killing people and eating them left and right, because that's what he had to do to survive. But the fact that, I mean, that you have the plot device where he has to make the tough decision to let some people die in order to let the mission succeed. But that plot device seems to be in opposition to this idea that he wants to do right by his fellow back of the trainers, because, you know, he feels bad for him, but he's just going to let him die in order to succeed in the mission. Like, the mission then goes from, I feel bad about being a horrible person, to, as long as one or two people survive this whole mission, I don't feel so bad about myself anymore, which seems kind of off balance to me.
Well, it is off balance. And it's not one or two people survive. It's that Ed Harris must be killed. Like, Wilford must be killed. Like, that is his single-minded focus.
Well, and I guess, yeah, that's right. There are still people in the back of the train that didn't come on the mission, which I totally forgot about until the very end there when they started walking through and shooting 74% of them for some stupid reason. But yeah, Wilford must die. Yeah. Okay.
Well, but see, this is the thing, though. When he finally gets to the end and has the opportunity, he hesitates for seemingly no reason, because he's just sort of impressed by all of this.
Well, and he's got a gun to him with the crazy lady who licked her own blood.
No. Yeah, with Claude. But I don't mean like he doesn't kill him. I meant like he is almost...
Oh, you mean the few minutes when he's standing there just sort of staring while listening to Ed Harris's proposition?
Yeah, when he looks like he's, you know, peed his pants or something. Like, when he can't figure out what he wants to do. And it's just when he's having this conflict in himself of like, oh, I've been chosen and everything was a lie the whole entire time, and it's a stupid lie. everything was a lie the whole entire time.
It's understandable that he would be conflicted, because the guy who he thought was leading him to do this was apparently in on it the whole time. But he doesn't play betrayal very well. He kind of denies it, which is his natural instinct. But then it looks by all accounts that he's buying into Ed Harris's spiel about the balance on the train, and it's about the we can't upset the apple cart and we got to maintain this, and I want you to be in charge of it now. And it's like, what?
Yeah, it's very strange. I don't understand it. And the even weirder part for me is in this thing where he's like hesitating on what he wants to do, whether or not he wants to assume this mantle or I guess get shot by Claude. Those are two options. When he's hesitating on this, then what's her face wanders in, and
the girl who is psychic for some inexplicable reason.
Yes. Clairvoyant. She can always see what's behind a door, etc. As we've established from several other previous doors, and by her knowing when what's his face didn't die from his thing that should have killed him.
Is she the only magical character aside from the guy we don't know anything about who doesn't die from his thing that should kill him?
Yeah, as far as we know. But she has, I mean, she could just be making some good guesses. Maybe she can just hear very well.
She's got very good hearing. Yeah. After spending all that time isolated in what was it called? The prison car, where they were all just sort of hanging out in like those freezers that you see in mortuaries.
Yeah, it was peculiar. But the at the end, and she goes in to get the matchbook, and he's like, "No, I'm not going to give you the matchbook," because reasons, I guess. He's still fishing around for feelings on this subject. And then she freaks out and realizes that she needs to lift the floor. She lifts the floor, and underneath is Tanya's son. And that's when he realizes that the train is is that he doesn't want to be in charge of something where there are these children that are running all of the machinery inside the engine. And I thought it was just a little strange, especially after he goes to try to stop this whole thing, and then the tube thing comes out from the top, and the other kid.
What the hell was that?
I have no idea. And then the other kid crawls out from inside of.
He was in a bookcase or something.
Yeah, he was inside the bookcase and the bottom shelf of the bookcase. He crawls out of there and then wanders up into the machine and it closes. And then we get, Ed Harris.
He must have been on that same stuff from Temple of Doom that they fed Indiana Jones to sort of brainwash him or whatever.
Yeah, I mean. Yeah, I don't know what they did to him in the span of a couple hours. But then we see Ed Harris do that weird hand twisty thing again, and we realize, oh, that's the cleaning the muck out of the gears, because the people have to do that now instead of the piece of machinery that used to do that or whatever. It's so strange. I couldn't piece it together with everything else in here, because it was it's saying that this is pure evil to keep this train running. But then at the same time, it's saying that stopping the train is good and people getting off is good because the snow will go away and then everyone will be free. I'm not sure about that one, because I think probably a lot of people died when that train stopped.
Well, the thing about it is they're... revolution proposition in the beginning of the movie seems to be that they want to kill Wilford and bring what's his name from Indiana Jones 4 and let him run the train now, because he would be a more just ruler.
John Hurt.
Sure. Okay.
What's his name? John Hurt.
Sorry, John Hurt. They kill a bunch of people in order to get there. Gigantic sacrifice in order to restore a just leader into this system. Presumably they're going to maintain some sort of system, but maybe something slightly more democratic. But they want a better leader than Wilford, because Wilford has been a mean leader and he's been feeding them grasshoppers. But then he gets to the front and Wilford's yeah, this whole thing is a sham and it's horrible, but that's what we got to do to survive. And even your mentor was on it. And somewhere in that sort of catatonic stare that Chris Evans has, he snaps and goes, this plan that cost all these lives that we've been working on this whole movie, it's all bull poop, burn it down. And then he gives the matches and he gives the go-ahead to blow it all up, which is kind of an extreme angle to take if this whole time your entire goal and everything you've sacrificed for is just to remove the guy who's in charge so you can recreate the system as you see fit. He goes from let's just modify this so we're a little more humane to the people in the back of the train, to burn it down, we're done pretty quick.
Yeah, well, presumably that switch is flipped when he sees the kid. That is the final straw of nothing good can come from this train.
And the reason behind that is because that piece broke and cannot be fixed, so they have to have a human. They walk past part of the train that had a dentist office. Maybe they could, take some stuff and rebuild part of the train. No,
Well, I don't know. Who knows how that was forged or made or anything? But again,
maybe
it seems
maybe it was built on quantum particle pixels, whatever the hell this thing was.
Oh yeah, it was a UHD media player in there. So
UHD train.
Oh god. Yeah, everybody, all aboard the UHD format train. This is what I have. Okay, and so another thing I should mention to you, because I don't know if you bothered to read around a little bit about the differences between the graphic novel and the movie, but the 1982 graphic novel apparently has none of these characters, and instead focuses on a character's journey from the back to the front and the quarantine situations and meeting all the different people in the different train cars and classes as he moves through. And there's 1,001 length train car train.
That how many train lengths that we're supposed to be?
Apparently. And then he gets to, not in the movie, obviously.
There were 20.
Yeah. And then he gets, to the front, and the whole entire time while he's going through, everybody's dying from some virus. And then he realizes that everybody on the train has died from the virus. And then he's the last one left alive, and that's it. And he's in charge of the train, but there's no one living. And so
Whoa, that's a rather dramatic departure.
Yes, yes, I thought so too. Because I was like, what does that have to do with the end of this movie? Because like, I was like, maybe the weird ending of this movie is because the director was very literal in his adaptation of the book. No. It has nothing to do with it at all. So he completely made up all of the stuff that's in here. Like the children operating machinery and everything.
The thing that I saw that confused me was that apparently one of the Weinsteins wanted to cut out like 20 minutes of the film because he thought it was unnecessary and it would make for a better film. And I look at this movie and I go, what would you possibly cut out? There is like, it already seems like there's a half hour of missing character development. Like, who are these people and why do I care about them? Like, that's the stuff that I'm missing. Like, where is that?
I guess
if you're saying the characters aren't actually in the graphic novel, they would have had to invent backstories for, you know, 30 odd people or whatever it was.
Well, no, I mean, the thing that they really should have done, I mean, I would also be curious to find out what he was planning on cutting. But my understanding is he had acquired the distribution rights to the film. Yeah. But that he didn't have any say over it when it was being made. So he just wanted to edit it before it was distributed in America. That was his goal. And the director pushed back on that because he didn't want to make the edits. And because the edits would have also included an opening and closing voiceover to explain things.
We kind of got the opening voiceover with that incredibly cliche radio and television announcers cut together over top of the credits explaining the whole global warming nonsense, which is a trope that I absolutely hate.
It didn't go on for too long, so it didn't bother me that much. But, you know, it was like all of the other, you know, like post-apocalypse things. It went to very quickly explain away the way that the world ended. You know, World War Z or whatever. But the thing is, I don't know what he would have added to the beginning of it to make it actually make any more sense at the beginning. And honestly, I didn't have that much of a time getting into it at the start. I had a hard time with it just keep... It kind of was running at the same pace as it was at the start for a large portion of it, where we didn't really know what was going to happen. It never, like you're saying, it never developed things very much. And so then it just became action pieces throughout, developing forward throughout as they moved through the train. And I think that's the part where I wonder if he was going to cut down on the action scenes. Because there's the completely pointless water processing fight that goes on for like 15 minutes. I don't understand that is...
The more concerning for me than the water processing fight was the we're going across a bridge now and suddenly that means it's New Year's, because something you'll learn later in the movie is that the train takes 1 year exactly to go all the way around the Earth. So everyone stop fighting for a minute, and the dying, bleeding guard next to you will smile at you and say Happy New Year before they say game on again and everyone start killing each other again. Like, there were so many just like back-to-back completely inscrutable moments that I didn't have a moment to even think about what was happening. It's like, okay, we're in trouble. We opened one of the doors and there's a ton of guys behind it who are all wearing masks that cover their eyes for some reason. And then a lot of people die.
Fish.
Then somebody puts fish blood on the blade of their axe, which is, I don't know, maybe, is that like a cultural thing? Is that insulting or like vile in some place that I'm not familiar with? I didn't understand that at all. And then they're killing each other with axes. And then the lights go out and they all have night vision goggles. So then the momentum is back in the other direction. So the guards start killing all the other guys. And then somebody lights up a match and they pull a bunch of torches out of somewhere. So clearly they had some kerosene or something and they've been planning that all along, and they run up with the torches and they overthrow the bad guys and they grab Tilda Swinton, and his jumper buddy dies, but he grabs Tilda Swinton, and now that's their ticket to the front of the train. That whole business back and forth was, if you take those plot points as I just described them, you can understand why the pacing was completely all over the place and indecipherable.
Yeah,
I don't even know what to say of that. Like, that was the moment where the majority of their attack crew was really blindsided all of a sudden because there were all of these guards there and they were ready and waiting for them. But then there's this giant like pause in the moment where we have that New Year's moment. I guess that entire New Year's moment existed just so the one guy could look out the window to see the airplane where the snow had been melting. Is that the entire reason that moment exists? I can't think of another one. And then I don't know why the night vision and then the other, the torches part exist. Maybe again, just so there's more, tension in the fight, but it's like, it's a bloody violent fight. It's like, it's slow motion, like 300 style. Like you can make your point without doing that.
Yeah, no, I agree. It didn't make any sense. It completely threw me out of the movie through the whole thing. And I have to say that the fight cinematography is probably some of the least interesting stuff because it is just cameras swishing and swimming and flying around and you don't know what's happening or who's being killed.
There are very few cuts. It's relatively wide angle and it's somebody shaking the living hell out of the camera, which is not a terribly effective way to illustrate chaos.
Yeah, no, I did not like it at all. I mean, there were other brilliant moments in here where the cinematography was very good, and I thought that they did a very nice job, and they had some pretty ingenious shots of, like, when they were on the bunks, and they had, like, the one guy facing one direction, the other guy facing the other direction, they were racking up and down between it. It was like, that's pretty clever, Mr. Cinematographer guy. I like that.
Yeah, and I guess they placed a pretty large kind of, not terribly arbitrary, but partially arbitrary limit on themselves in the fact that they're in this confined space of a train. So what do you do within that space is kind of restricted comparatively. But I don't even know who to call to the table for that. Like, it's a directing, editing, and cinematography choice in those fight scenes where we're basically one camera angle and somebody is shaking it violently. Like, that's not... it's not an effective way to do things. Like, you could cut around it, presumably, if there's more footage, or you could direct the camera through the action in a better way, or you could, I don't know, stage the characters in a different way. There were so many different things they could have done, but yeah, there were several instances where it's just like, this is a really boring fight, but they're just shaking the camera really hard right now because they want it to seem dramatic, and it did not work at all.
Yeah, no, it was a mess, and a lot of that would have been solved by that fight. Just if that had just been written differently, like I found the whole thing just threw me out of the movie. And I had been largely on board with what was going on and interested in what I would see in the next train car up until that point. And then once we got to that and we got through that scene, I was like, well, at least we have Tilda Swinton. She'll you know, make this slightly more interesting. And
she looked like one of her Wes Anderson characters, like, hooked up with a Tim Burton character, and that's what happened.
Okay. But I liked her and I liked her performance. I didn't understand it, like you're saying with the teeth thing. It took me a second to figure out that she was implying that she apparently had been punished by having her teeth knocked out or something. It was not clear. But apparently that's the reason why she's willing to go along with them, is if they promise to kill Wilford. And we quickly find out that that's kind of not really true for her. But I thought the sushi scene was kind of strange and funny.
You mean after they go through the greenhouse car and the aquarium car, mm-hmm. which is very densely packed, that aquarium car. I think that water would probably be rife with animal pollutants if it was that dense with wildlife. But yeah, then they sit down and have sushi. I guess that's one of the many instances where they start to hint at this perpetual balance that they have had to maintain for 18 years or whatever it is. But I would have potentially done it a different way.
Yeah, well, but see, there's another thing with the theme of this movie of balance. I disagree, because nothing about this seems balanced. Unless you're trying to say that by punishing so severely some minority of people that they brought on board, that somehow makes the rest of the train better, I don't understand. Or if it's supposed to be like some sort of a, at least you're not in the back of the train kind of a thing. Like, I have no idea what the point of this situation is. The stratification doesn't seem to make any logical sense. The with the sushi and everything. It's just like, so they have the means to do well for themselves, and they could,
as long as the population doesn't grow or change.
Yes, but they even hint at, you know, like, oh, well, we could, you know, theoretically grow more stuff. We could do more things. But it doesn't make any sense then why it's so oppressive towards this other group. Like, it just doesn't... It's not like a society like we have today where there's a history of oppression, where it's like, oh, well, they are... you know, oppressed for reasons X, Y, and Z. And with this stuff in the train, it's just like, they're just oppressed because they're in the back of the car because we brought them on that one time, and then we just let them suffer. And then sometimes we pull people out of it, and then we let them get culled every now and then just for fun. Like, it's so strange. I don't understand the thinking there. I mean, clearly Ed Harris's character is insane, but it seems like everyone else is also clearly bananas, because it doesn't the structure doesn't make any sense. And
yeah, and they kind of glossed over it, but it seems to be building on this idea that when we all got on this train, there was an understanding that there were people with means who got more. We let you guys on just because we had the room and we could, but don't expect anything from us aside from the fact that we saved your lives, because the world would kill you otherwise. And then there's just this sort of like this understood structure whereby no one will ever change their position. Like, you got on this train 18 years ago, and you're going to sit right where you got on 18 years ago for all eternity until you die, which is a little drastic.
Well, except for Curtis, which doesn't make any sense either, because Curtis...
Why he got called up to the big leagues? Yeah.
Yeah, Curtis doesn't know anything about life in the train aside from where he's been in the train. So,
well,
why...
I mean, he lived outside for 17 years, even though he claims he doesn't remember or doesn't want to remember it, but...
No, but he doesn't understand how things function on the train. Like, he's only been in the back of the train up until very recently, where he walked through this part. So he doesn't understand anything about... How would he be equipped to be a leader? It doesn't make any sense, other than like, oh, he has leadership skills. Like, what does that have to do with anything?
It probably starts as any revolution does, which is step one, unseat the dictator. Step two, figure it out from there, which is why it never usually goes very well. But
I'm talking about Ed Harris's selection of him. Like, why did
Ed Harris select him?
It doesn't make any sense.
If I would have guessed, I would have said Ed Harris would have picked him to run the back of the train, not the front. But I don't know. It doesn't make any sense. But I should explain for a moment that there were a number of things either that I just missed or I didn't understand in the beginning there. Like, when they came in to steal the kids, is that something that happens regularly, or is that just happening this one time? Apparently it's a recent thing, because who knows when that train part broke, but it seems to be relatively recent in the 18-year scheme of things. I had no idea. The way that lady licked the blood off of her head, I thought they were taking the kids to go eat them. And then later, once I found out there was some manner of cannibalism on the train that happened at some point, I was still uncertain as to whether or not the kids were taken up front and eaten, because Ed Harris is cooking a steak. Is he cooking a child there? Is that what I'm about to find out? No, turns out the child is in the bookcase and the bottom. Or was it the fact that the kid who was down underneath doing the gunk pulling got too tall to fit in there, so they took him out and ate him and then put a smaller kid in there? Like, I have no idea what is happening to any of these people.
Yeah, but see, this is one of those things where, like we're saying, we don't understand, and it's not explained adequately, and so then we're left with these scenes where we're just, like, questioning plot choices, because we can't focus on anything else, and so that doesn't help. I really don't understand the critically high score and acclaim that this film has earned. I feel like I must be a bad person because I don't get it or something, but...
No, this is... we probably have a Prometheus thing going on. It's very complicated and you don't understand it, which probably means it's really good and you just need to watch it five more times to understand it, which I don't... That argument doesn't work with me. Like, there are so many things that are... I can't imagine any way that this movie even subtly explained these things. Like the train goes around a curve and there's a gunfight from across the curve. Which
that was so
stupid. Chris Evans is using that little miniature handheld automatic pistol, which in no way would ever work. And the other guy's got a sniper rifle. But what was that? That's also the character guy that I have no idea who he is or why. I mean, he's the guy who killed his little buddy or whatever. But why is he the adversary at this point? And why is he killing his own men for getting in his way of accomplishing his duties? Like, he doesn't have any words in this movie. Like, God. But yeah, the gunfight on the curve. Like, why? Why was that there? He wasted an entire magazine and then more just to prove that he could hit the guy, but not kill him because it wouldn't go through the glass.
Well, that was the whole thing, though. The whole entire time it was happening, I was like, why is anyone shooting the only bullets that they have out a window? It doesn't make any sense. Wait until he's closer, and then you can shoot him in his face. Like, yeah. I don't understand. And clearly, the glass is so strong, or ceramic or whatever material it is so strong that it takes several rounds to get through it at all. So how are you going to get through your side across the distance into the other glass with enough force to break it without shooting exactly the same number of shots in the same spot on the other side as you shot to break through the glass on your side? So if it takes you 10 shots to break through your glass, it's going to take you 10 shots in exactly the same spot on the other side of the train. Good luck with that.
They both shot holes through their glass, so he was probably trying to thread the needle on the other side. But the other question is, for 18 years of his adult life, he has never touched a gun. How was he such a good marksman?
Oh, no, that doesn't make any sense either. And he doesn't look through the sight on it. Well, there's no sights on it.
No, that's I think that gun's a Scorpion, I think is the name of that thing. That thing is not, there's no way that would have actually worked. The other guy had a sniper rifle, at least. But there's no way his bullet would have been anywhere in the vicinity of that guy. So it doesn't matter if he looked at the sight or not.
Yeah, but another thing that doesn't make any sense is, like, they're already through the whole entire glass corridor train car that they were in to the part where they have coverage to go into the next car. So just go into the next car. Like, I don't understand. What did you get out of that?
Save those bullets on, like, closing one of the gates and shooting the mechanism that lets it open. Maybe do that so the guy can't come chase you.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many other things you could have. I don't understand what that is. It doesn't make any sense in the pacing of the film. I don't care about the other guy who's shooting. Like,
but
the whole.
This is where the film descends into madness. There's an entire train car dedicated to little personal sauna rooms.
Yeah, well, but that whole scene that transpires in there is just sort of tragic and drawn out. And so it doesn't, like, the characters in there die. Octavia Spencer dies. And she is arguably, next to Curtis, I would say, the most developed of the characters on these trains. Like, she has,
which is to say, we spent enough time with her to know that she has a kid, the kid was taken from her, and she wants her kid back. That's about it.
Yeah, I know, but at least it gives her something to do. The other ones, not so much. The whole ride through with Kang Ho and what's her name? Yona. Like, they don't. They're just sort of like comic relief, basically, because, like, they're just strung out druggies until the very end of the movie.
Although, yeah, we upended your expectation again. They're not druggies. They're making a bomb out of drugs, which, did I hear that correctly? The drugs are human waste that has been distilled?
No. Industrial waste from the engine.
Industrial waste. Okay, yeah. That's better, but yeah. Not much.
No. Well, see, the whole thing, they say it several times at the beginning. They mentioned that they got the stuff and that it is industrial waste, and not to breathe it, people hallucinate, et cetera, et cetera. And then John Hurt, I think, says, oh, and it's flammable. And they say it, like, again, another point. Be careful with that. It's flammable. Because when he's lighting his, I think when he's lighting his cigarette or something, like, be careful with it because it's flammable. They go through the whole thing of saying that a couple times, and I'm like, so when are they going to blow it up? Like, you don't have something that you tell everybody, like, be careful, it's flammable, twice without it actually blowing up at some point. It's going to blow up. And sure enough, at the very end, he says it's flammable again, and they blow it up.
There was the moment, like, right before the Wilford gate where he's like, I want all of the cubes. I want more, even though they just spent like two train cars walking past like stoned people at a rave and just like stealing all of the cubes off their table. Like he picked up like 50 or 60 of them, just stealing them from people who were blacked out. And it's like, that looks to be enough for a bomb to me. So whatever, but he wants more. And that's when we get the exposition about what he's going to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but it also doesn't make any sense too. I'll wait to get to that. Like you're saying, let's get to the exposition. It doesn't make any sense. There are flashbacks to scenes in the movie that we just sat through, which is never a good sign. That is just not a good thing to do.
Which flashbacks? I'm missing them now. I can't even, maybe I blacked them out.
Oh, he's flashing back to when he saw the tail of the plane, when they were going over the bridge.
And as hard as I looked, I didn't see any plane down there.
Yeah, well, I didn't. You could barely see it on the second time they did the shot because they like zoomed in a little. There was the snowflake that goes in front of his face. They had that in the flashback too. And he's like, "Oh, you know, I knew the person that tried to break out before, and the one that died." It's like, "Oh, well," and she knew that there were different kinds of snow, and that we could survive out there, and that the snow is going away because it's. There's enough of the plane visible now that I can see it, so it must be disappearing. And it's like,
that's some super scientific measurement there. The part of the plane is exposed, hence the temperature is now human livable.
Yeah, I mean, it could have just been a strong wind or like an avalanche or something. Like it might not necessarily have anything to do with anything melting. So the whole thing doesn't make any sense there. The fact that we got to have that little flashback moment, I hate it, because I don't want to see scenes in a movie that I just saw. It shouldn't be a reveal that those meant anything. You should just be showing me things that are happening going forwards. Like, I don't need to revisit this. It's a 2-hour movie. Get your point across.
Well, maybe tell me if I'm being too pedantic here, but is it too reductive to say that this entire movie would have been circumvented if somebody on the train owned a thermometer?
Why?
Like, cut a hole in the wall and stick the thermometer outside and see how cold it is?
No, then you'd lose your hand.
Yeah, right. Well, even the people up front who have the means, wouldn't they kind of be... Okay, so Wilford is supposed to be made out to be this character who had a love of trains his entire life, and in that stupid little movie they play for the kids, he says, "I want to live on a train for my whole life." Like, okay, clearly he's bat poop crazy, but is there nobody in the front of the train who was like, "Hey guys, I know we've been on here for like 18 years. I would still rather maybe go back to society if it worked and we wouldn't die. So maybe let's keep track of what's going on outside and not just like close the doors and be like, well, let's wash our hands of the earth from now until the end of eternity because there's no way it's ever going to get better." Like, why wouldn't anybody be keeping track of what's going on outside at all, ever?
Well, we don't know that they're not. We just, because it's not like... We get to the front of the train and we find out that it's a utopian paradise outside the whole entire time. Like the walls were simulated or something like that. Like that reveal never occurs. Like it is plenty cold outside of this train right now. You would not survive, which I don't understand why the end of this movie is technically a happy ending. With the train cars all getting derailed and destroyed and well, like...
Almost the polar bear means that you can survive, apparently, is
yeah,
what that
yeah.
means.
Yeah, I'd read up on... there was some commentary from the director, and he's like, "Yeah, it's supposed to be a hopeful ending." And I'm like, what? Like, the message there of a singular polar bear was visible on this ridiculous mountain that they're on that is covered completely in snow is not an indication that they will do okay.
Well, it means that it's not too cold for life to exist. Yeah, obviously she's going to have to figure out how to build a shelter pretty darn quick or they're going to die when the sun goes down. But
yeah, and then her and the kid are going to go polar bear hunting. Like what is the plan?
Well, they'll probably sort through the train cars for food or dead people to eat. But the point there remains, like, if, okay, maybe they just got to this part of the earth and this part of the earth is the only one that's warm enough. Like, if the ending is that life is sustainable outside of the train, why didn't we try to find that out before we decided to blow up everything? Like, maybe just, let's try not to murder everyone. Let's just try and figure out if we can get off this. If the system of this like front of the train versus back of the train thing is not working for you in the back of the train, maybe find out if it's cool to get off. Like, I don't know. Like, I don't know. I wish there would have been some exploration of the outside temperature beyond the one crazy guy who did not mention anything until literally everyone was dead and he was about to blow up the train. Like, that's the only time we hear anyone even considering whether or not they could get off the train and survive.
Well, the really dumb part about his plan is that his plan is to blow it up, not knowing what effect the explosion will have. Because he doesn't really want to kill everyone. He just wants to get off the train. And he knows that the door is frozen shut. So he's hoping that he can just blow it up with enough force that he can leave the train. Which he was planning to do in the room where the bomb was going to go off originally. And because that was originally the plan. Before Claude opens the door and shoots him. And then we go through the whole thing of the door being opened and them doing that thing and then like, oh no, they can't close the door. So then it's like, well, did the explosion take out everything because the fire swept up into the engine room? Or did if that door had been shut, would that explosion, would everyone have been fine? Or like, I don't understand. Like, it seemed like everything just seemed like a dumb plan. Everything. All the plans were dumb plans.
Right, so if they would have hid in Wilford's car to blow up the snow door would have opened, but the avalanche still would have derailed everyone, and they probably would have gotten real messed up or died. But it didn't, so they sacrificed themselves to save the girl and the kid, Yona, and the whatever his kid's name was.
Yeah.
They're just... And maybe it's them trying to be... misleading or clever. I mean, clever is not the right word, but you know, they showed the seven people that froze to death. So that's supposed to close the door on our expectation that they could leave the train and survive. They get up to Wilford and it turns out the other guy was in on it all along. So that's supposed to circumvent our expectation that the guy who was planning to take over for Wilford and be a more benevolent ruler was actually going to do that all along. So it turns out that they just wanted to maintain the caste system all along. So for every clever moment in this movie, there's a misleading moment earlier in the movie that's meant to sort of make it seem like that's not what's going to happen, and then it happens, and then it's still not satisfying. Like, I don't know. It's a big bucket full of Lego blocks that are assembled in some manner, but it does not create a pleasing Lego toy for me.
No,
it's a very weird metaphor. Lego trains and blocks.
Yeah. Well, you tried.
And it was not a very uplifting movie either.
No, God no. I was watching this with Jason. And he bailed on it. He's like, I thought you said this wasn't going to be like a scary, weird movie. And I was like, well, it's not like strictly speaking a horror, scary movie. It's like just sort of violent and pointless. And then so by the time we had gotten to the water room and like that fight had gone on for 5 minutes, he's like, yeah, we're not watching this anymore. And so then I had to watch it later after he went to sleep.
I don't know what I was expecting. Yeah. I knew it was some sort of like alternate universe dystopian thing, but this is not what I expected, which is fine, I guess.
No, I'm really glad that we followed up our super happy fun time December and our great clip show that you worked so hard on with this uplifting TVs are terrible, we hate movies and everything's the worst. That was a good way to cap off our 2014 year and start 2015 with some vim and vigor.
Yeah, we're just getting this one out of the way so we don't have to pull clips from it next year.
Oh God! Please, no one put this in the clip suggestions.
No, no one's gonna remember this by the time we get there. Nobody suggested World War Z for last year, so
mm-hmm. Or Guardians. You know, no one had a selection from Guardians.
Yeah, well, and you know, this movie, like you said, there were some interesting things. It does dystopian in a different way, which is potentially interesting to some people. But I guess the all of this hour and 20 minutes is to say, this is not really the movie for me. It's not really my kind of thing.
Yeah. Can we stop talking about this and never speak of it again?